A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Ram, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 25, 2001, in the series Spirituality in the Modern World, entitled Living with a True Myth. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 3, verses 1 through 10, and Romans 5, verses 12 through 21. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I'll tell you the story. A story Jesus told, a parable about the householder who had a vineyard, who went to the labor market and hired some workers at 6 o'clock in the morning and agreed with them for a day's wage. And then he went back at 9 o'clock and there were some standing around, and he sent them out into the field too and said, "Look, I'll make it right with you." And then there were some more at 12 and at 3 and then an hour before closing. And at the end of the day, he called his steward and he said, "Pay them, beginning with the last." And so the last came and he got the day's wage that the householder had bargained with the people in the first place. And they all got the same, as a matter of fact, whether they had worked 12 hours or 1 hour. And of course, those who started early grumbled, and they said, "This is not fair." And the householder said, "Look, did I give you what we bargained for?" They said, "Yes." He said, "Then am I not able to do with what I have as I will? Why do you challenge my generosity?" It's a parable. It's a wonderful parable. It's a parable about the nature of God, of course, about the generosity of God, about the incalculable aspect of God's grace and God's generosity. And you could go a lot of different places with that story in terms of its meaning and its significance. That's the neat thing about parables, is they allow the imagination to be triggered and to think about it and to think of all kinds of implications. That's what myths do. Now, it's probably foolish for me to try to reclaim the word myth for a religious story or a biblical story, because myth has become to be so commonly regarded as something that isn't true. And so maybe to try to reclaim that word is just to run roughshod into that common current interpretation and lose the point altogether. But I'll try it anyway. Because myth originally meant a story, like a metaphor, a story that was not to be taken literally, but rather a story that had a deep, profound meaning in it. In the parable of Jesus, we never had a problem with parables. I don't know why. I suppose because they're called parables, and parables are what Jesus told. Jesus told parables because Jesus knew religious truth needs to be told, communicated through stories. So we never had any problem with the fact that Jesus used parables that weren't literally true. There wasn't a householder, there wasn't a labor market, there wasn't a particular vineyard. This thing didn't happen, and that doesn't even faze us because we understand it was a story, and it conveys profound truth. Well, this is the nature of myth as well. It's not that one cannot prosaically lay out exactly what one means, perhaps, but to tell a story, it has such power of presentation, and it evokes the imagination. It can be remembered, and it stimulates all kinds of other thoughts and associations. And myth is really the manner in which religious truth is communicated. And I want to suggest this morning that if only we could understand that, if only we could accept our Christian story as a grand myth about the ultimate meaning of things. Now it gets a little complicated because our Christian story actually deals with historical events and personages. Nonetheless, the story itself is an interpretation of some things that happened way back when. And if we could hear those stories as interpretations with deep meanings, then we wouldn't run into this conflict between our knowledge of the world and the natural world, the universe, human person, and our religious teaching. Because we would understand that if you want to know about the universe, you go to science. You don't go to the Bible. You don't go to the Bible to find out something about creation or something about geology or biology or whatever. You go to the sciences because in the modern period, the last three centuries, the scientific community has uncovered amazing knowledge of the natural world. So the use of the scientific method, empirical investigation, we have amazing knowledge. And the more knowledge we gain, the more mysterious it becomes. It's fascinating and wonderful. I clipped an article out of the New York Times the other day, which because of the Tuesday night class, I'm triggered with those things. They catch my attention. Something with a headline about a new discovery about particles pokes holes in the standing current understanding of science. And so the article went on to say how science is going to have, the physics is going to have to go back and rethink, add some equations in the light of this new understanding of particles, which was accomplished because there was a new accelerator that was able to smash them or whatever. I don't understand that stuff, but it's fascinating to know that the scientific community itself is constantly having to revise its understanding. But what it does know and what it can demonstrate, that's wonderful. The Human Genome Project, oh my goodness. What are the implications of that? Now, I delight in my delight in following that because I can remember a time when every new movement of science put the fear into me that somehow or other my religious faith was being challenged, or that somehow or other there wouldn't be room for God. I can remember that conflict in my own being until finally I came to see that our religious interpretations, our stories, are not in order to give us empirical knowledge of the cosmic reality of which we're a part. I mean, that's a given. And more is being uncovered, and we know so much today, and yet I'm told that we probably have only scratched the surface of the nature of reality. But given that, how then am I to live? Given that, what's the meaning of it all? Given that, what do I, a human being, how do I live? How do I image reality? And what about that within me that seems to be something that is so elusive that no doctor's stethoscope can determine it, no blood in a test tube can explain it, that deep, intuitive, religious sense that I have? Well, I've come to see that is a layer of reality that is beyond the capability of science. And there are those who say, well, there is no other layer. If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. I'm not dealing with those folks. I'm dealing with those who recognize that there is that legitimate scientific method to understand the natural world, but who leave open the possibility that there is something to that idea of the holy or the sacred or God, call it what you will, that deep intuitive sense of the human being, that there is such a thing as soul or spirit. And our religion, all of the great religious traditions, our Christian tradition, has a story. Now, as I said, it's tangled up with some historical events, but its interpretation is a story. As I read Genesis 3, the story of Adam and Eve and the temptation and the fall, it just amazes me that I ever read that as though it was a literal historical account, you know, of the day after creation, 6 o'clock in the morning or something. Isn't it so obviously a myth? So obviously a myth. And what's it about? Well, it's a profound story about the human dilemma. And I could preach a whole series of sermons on Genesis 3 and all of the associations and implications of that portrayal of the human situation. Paul took that story and he made it a basis on which he came to an understanding of what happened in Jesus Christ. I think if you've been able to go back a decade or two or three behind Paul to Jesus and said, "This is what Paul said your death and resurrection meant," Jesus would have said, "What?" That was an interpretation of events. That was the forming of a story around events, giving them meaning, bringing about understanding. Paul's understanding was that as God started with Adam in the first place, and there was failure, sin, guilt, alienation, so in order to rectify the whole situation, God came again with a second Adam. As in Adam all sinned and death came on all, so in Christ shall all be made alive, all be made righteous. That was Paul's weaving of a story of meaning around his experience of Jesus. It wasn't John's understanding, and I don't have time this morning to talk about the comparison of the two, but the first chapter of John in the beginning was the Word was the intention of God, and that intention of God took on flesh, so that in the midst of this human scene, there was enfleshed, embodied in a human like us, a reflection of the eternal God. That was John's story. It was more revelation and incarnation and so forth. It doesn't really matter. It's just the fact. All I'm trying to say is that what we have in our biblical stories are interpretive movements of those founding events, whether in the case of the Hebrew Scriptures, Moses and the burning bush and the Exodus, or whether in the case of our Christian tradition, Jesus, birth, death, resurrection, etc. The stories we've told, the stories in here, are attempts to communicate the meaning of it all. And if we could have always understood that, then we wouldn't have had to live in this tension between our knowledge of the world and our everyday human experience and our knowledge of faith and our spiritual experience. What we are going through today in terms of the expanding knowledge of the natural world and the ongoing conflict with that knowledge in case of creationism and the opponents of Darwinianism and all of that kind of stuff, and the multitudes who have left because they just shake their head and say it doesn't make sense. What we're going through today, it has been gone through before, in the 18th century with the exploding knowledge of the natural world at that time, there arose a counter movement, the Romantic movement. Poets, artists, those who were soulful, those who said, this mechanistic idea of the universe as a machine, the human being as a cog in a machine, that's not enough. And so they wrote of God and nature, and they sang of the soul and so forth. It was a time when the precursors of Darwin are writing, and the universe seemed to be just this heartless, brutal, ruthless, unraveling, natural phenomenon. Tennyson lost a dear friend, struggling in his grief, pessimistic about the nature that was being presented to him through the natural sciences, spoke of species, whole species, having lived and being gone, of nature's ruthlessness, of its waste, throwing whole species on the ash heap of history. He spoke of nature as red in tooth and claw. Nancy and I were watching the other night. She had something on one of those Discovery Channels or something, and there was some little animal that was attacked by a wolf, and you know, you see that natural drama going on, and you hope for that little creature to be able to get back in its den and so forth. But that's nature. Nature, red in tooth and claw. That's just the way it is. But if we can only see that natural world as the stage on which we're living our human drama, if we can see all of that and then say, but what else is there? And this is what Tennyson was trying to do. You know, if you've been with me for a while, if you've been around long enough, you'll know that on Thursday of this week, March 1, I'll be celebrating my 30th year of return here. So for 30 years, what I've been doing here was expressed by Tennyson in that beautiful, long poem, In Memoriam. The hymn, Strong Son of God, Immortal Love, that we sing here, probably more often than you care to because it's my favorite. And the third verse, which is my creed. Our little systems have their day. They have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they. Those lines were pinned up on the drape of my Professor Berikoff in my initial interview with him, and I looked at those lines and I said, that's my teacher. And I can look back over 30 years and say, you know what you've been about? You've been about trying to dismantle that system, to understand that system, to see that that system in which you were nurtured and in which you were trained, that that system is but a broken light of God. And I think I've come to see that so that I can have the system back again with a second naivete, knowing that it's not an absolute statement of truth, but it's a view, it's a glimpse. It's an interpretive movement. But O. Tennyson went on after that marvelous statement about our little systems having their day, they being but broken lights of God. He went on to write, let knowledge grow from more to more, but more of reverence in us dwell, that mind and soul according well may make one music as before. I said to myself, that's my verse for the next 30 years. That's where I am. The deists, the theologians, were scampering to find room for God as the 18th century dawned. The deist made God the watchmaker out here, way apart from reality. Nature was running on by itself. Very well, thank you very much. But how can you still have God? So you put God out here, the engineer, the grand watchmaker. He makes it all, winds it up, lets it tick off on its own. Oh, occasionally he intervenes and interrupts, but only occasionally. For the most part, no sign of God. The deists were scrambling, as we theologians do, always trying to find a little niche for God. And I think Tennyson was sick of that. He said, let knowledge grow from more to more. Why should I fight knowledge? It's futile. It's foolish. Why should I fight knowledge? Let knowledge grow from more to more. But more of reverence in me dwell. That mind and soul according well may make one music as before. That's why I'm struggling to find an authentic spirituality in our day. That's why we work at these things, so that our human experience will not be bifurcated between our everyday world and everything we know out there, and then, oh, Sunday, oh, God, no. In fact, the more we learn about our natural world, sometimes there's even a better story that could be told. Maybe rather than that perfection and fall and redemption, I could better think, as I suggested last week, of the emergence of the human being in this long billions and billions and years of creative evolutionary development, to the point at which we become the expression of God. God in us. Not some grand manipulator beyond us, but the spirit that's seeking to come to expression through us. My, now that's a grand thought. And that's enough to contemplate for the next 30 years, really. God in us. Let knowledge grow from more to more. Ah, but dear God, let more of reverence in me dwell. That mind and soul accord may accord well. And may make one music as before. That, you see, would be to live within a true myth.